Thanks for joining us back here at the OIS Podcast. Register for our upcoming Gene Therapy Innovation Showcase taking place on February 18th by visiting OIS.net/events. And while you're on our site, click Get Involved to submit your information if you'd like to be featured on our podcast. Let's get into this week's discussion. On this episode, our host, Dr. Paul Karpecki, sits down with Dr. Kim Brazell, Chief Medical Officer at Kella Pharmaceuticals. Kim shares his experience getting EYSUVIS to market and gives us a few new ways to approach the often laborious process of FDA approval and navigating regulatory hurdles. He also shares some of the bigger lessons he's learned from working in dry eye. Let's listen in.
Hello, welcome to the OIS Podcast. I'm Dr. Paul Karpecki. I practice in Lexington, Kentucky, and I'm honored today to have a special guest who just coming off some great success with the approval, FDA approval of EYSUVIS. But really, today's podcast is really to take us through an understanding of kind of, you know, what Kim Brazell, Dr. Brazell, has been able to achieve over the years, kind of his background, where he grew up. I got there some insights and pearls around the entire regulatory process. I know we have a lot of listeners that have key interest in this, that, you know, there's been many dry eye drugs that have never quite made it through, and some are probably pretty good. So there's a lot of understanding of the field of disease of this area, and we've got a perfect guest to be able to present. So welcome, Kim. Great to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to be with you, Paul.
Thanks, Kim. I mean, we really could have just gotten together. We live about 10 minutes apart in Lexington.
<That's right.
laughs> Any other time of year, we could have done this.
We would have had masks on, though. So
yeah, good point. This is a little better. Well said. Hey, Kim, if you don't mind, let's briefly walk us through your personal background. Like, even growing up, where you grew up, your education, kind of what was your professional path into eye care, and especially now, you know, leading regulatory for a public company in Kella Pharmaceuticals.
Well, I grew up in Kentucky, in Western Kentucky, a small town. And worked in a pharmacy in high school, so became a bit intrigued by drugs and how they act, and you know, how people develop new drugs and address some of the problems there. I went to school at the University of Kentucky, both undergraduate and graduate, so I'm still a diehard Wildcats fan, although it's not so easy this year. My first job out of school was working at Hoffman LaRoche in New Jersey, more on the clinical pharmacology side. And after about 5 years there, I got a call from a professor who asked if I'd be interested in moving to Texas to Alcon. And I'll be honest, I got into eye care not so much because of my interest in the eye, but my interest in getting out of New Jersey. So I moved to Alcon, and as a young scientist, did a lot of various different things in the clinical area, the preclinical area, and clinical pharmacology. And it was back when Alcon was really becoming, you know, a major force in the arena. From Alcon, I went to Storrs, which was part of Lederle at that point, and ran the R&D group there. Learned a lot on the device side, as well as we were starting a pharmaceutical side. We got bought. It was part of American Home Products. American Cyanamid. They got bought by American Home Products. So I decided I didn't want to be part of that. So moved from there to Ciba Vision in Atlanta and ran the R&D in the U.S. on the pharmaceutical side. Ran clinical worldwide, and Ciba Vision or Ciba and Sando merged to become Novartis. So I continued to run R&D in the U.S. and then ran clinical globally. We got three products approved, a glaucoma med, Visudyne, the first treatment for AMD. People never think about that anymore. And then Zaditor, which you may see at your local pharmacy now because it's OTC. I moved from, again, folded the ophthalmic group into big pharma there. And so I moved to Inspire Pharmaceuticals. I ran the ophthalmology R&D there. We were in both cystic fibrosis and ophthalmology. I think most people will remember Azacite, which we developed and introduced and became a major product. I also ran the business, the ophthalmology business there for a couple of years. We got purchased by Merck, and I went out and became a consultant. One of my clients was Kala Pharmaceuticals, and I liked the company. I liked the technology. I liked the CEO. So after a few months of that, I got brought on. They asked me to join full time, which I did. There I run the, you know, the clinical group, the regulatory group, the project management group, medical affairs, all those sorts of things.
It's a lot of hats you wear as a CMO, that's for sure, major company.
And it's a lot of companies for only being in my mid-40s.
Yeah, it's impressive. I can't imagine what's going to happen over the next 40 years for you. You've done it really well. It really is. You probably learned a lot along the way. You've held CMO roles or led the organization in R&D a number of times now. You know, it's a tough question, but, you know, what have you learned along the way? Kind of like that you wish you'd even known today, or, you know, that you know today that you wish you might have known in one of the first or second company, or maybe the third, or maybe when you first started running that level of chief medical officer for one of these companies.
Well, I think, you know, a couple of things I've learned is, first of all, you learn from your mistakes, and that makes me a very bright person. But I've also learned that you need to, you know, go back and dissect the mistakes that were made. And then as you approach everything new, and I urge my folks to do this, is sit down and imagine, for example, clinical trial, the day after it fails, and imagine what you would be saying, I wish I had done this. Just to make sure you're thinking about everything, because you... In clinical trials in the pharmaceutical world, you don't get that many shots. I mean, you have the primary endpoints, you got to hit them. You have to design the trials well. So I've learned that you really, a lot of thought goes into clinical design and that you have to not only come up with a design, but challenge yourself to try to understand what could go wrong and try to mitigate that before you start a trial rather than after.
Makes sense. Without giving away, you know, trade secrets, you know, you look over the last two decades, someone has told me, you know, 17, 18 companies have tried this route of approval in dry
eye. 23, our last count.
23 without, and only three approved to date, with Suvis, your drug, being the most recent, as the third. What did you see missing? What was there, you know, what did you see that others didn't see besides, you know, dissecting previous mistakes and understanding it that allowed you to get this drug through FDA approval?
I gained a lot of benefit from the past failures, and I was involved in one or two of those. And, you know, the couple of things I learned was, particularly around symptoms, when we first started doing these trials, you would ask patients, you know, 20 questions, rate your burning, rate your stinging, rate your foreign body sensation. They'd have a list of 20 or so questions. And we did a postmortem when I was at Inspire on a couple of our trials and talked to some patients in the trials. And they said, honestly, I got very confused. You know, I don't know the difference in burning or stinging or grittiness or foreign body sensation. So I was just checking the same thing. I think what's happened over the years is we've learned to utilize more global scales. For example, ours was a fairly simple question of how do you rate the degree of ocular discomfort? So we didn't ask the 20 questions. We also did it on a daily matter using a visual analog scale. And I think that helped too, because it helps you capture every day how the patients are reacting and allows you to sort of level out some of the day-to-day variability. So I think that's been very important. And the other thing is really understand the drug you're studying, understand what it does, and choose your endpoints appropriate for that. For example, we used conjunctival hyperemia as a primary endpoint. We're working with an anti-inflammatory drug. You know, the hyperemia is a hallmark sign of inflammation. So that was a logical choice to do that. And the last thing is you have to work closely with the FDA. You have to listen. You do have to challenge, but you have to listen because they've seen a lot of these as well. And every program I've worked on, it's sort of been hand in hand with the agency. And it makes it a lot easier at the end if you've talked with them from the very beginning.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think the agency has been very fair about, you know, this is what's required. You get to pre-specify. We work with you. They have a good understanding of the disease, the lack of correlation between signs and symptoms. Makes a key role. I think also time frame. You know, I guess it makes sense with a steroid to have a shorter term time frame, but it probably contributed too as well to really a great decision. So we have a lot of, you know, I'm noticing a fair number of ophthalmology, even optometry colleagues that have looked at roles where they're chief scientific officer or looking towards even CMO type roles. What advice would you give to someone who's just starting out that playing some roles in that area, but could aspires to that maybe in a few decades or however long they can to gain the experience?
I think a couple of things is, first of all, to realize you can't do it all yourself and to get as good a people as you can around you and not be intimidated by someone that has a different viewpoint or a different perspective. I think that's very helpful. Whenever you think you've got it figured out, then you're probably wrong. You need to step back and talk with others and make sure you really have it figured out. I've worked at large companies like Novartis, small companies like Kala. We're getting bigger. I think you sort of need to look and see which is the better atmosphere for you. Large companies tend to have more resources. And so you can potentially develop more. Small companies, I think you have more opportunity, you have more influence. Small companies, you sometimes tend to work harder, so you spend a lot of energy, but they're also very energizing in my experience. So I think it's important when you're looking at getting into industry to understand who the company is and what it is you want to do. Do you want to work in a big pharma amongst the bureaucracy and have a lot of support groups around you, somebody that takes care of everything, or smaller companies where in many cases you become a jack of all trades?
Mm-hmm. You've done a good job of surrounding yourself with quality people. It makes a big difference. Any mentors along the way that kind of helped in that, or that you learned from to allow you to get to the success and to the level you're at today?
Well, I've had numerous mentors, none to that I would really call out. I've had a lot along the way, and I've tried to be mentors to others as well.
You sure have.
So I think that's important, to find someone that can steer you along the way, and then be able to give back to the next person to help steer them as well.
It's awesome. ISUVA is a very exciting drug. I've been lucky to get to prescribe it, and we're having good success in clinic with it. It's doing everything we expected it would do, and giving that short-term sign and symptom resolution. The timing's perfect. I've only had a few weeks now, and it'll obviously, by the time the podcast airs, doctors will have more experience. So where do you see this drug succeeding the most in terms of, because you have great R&D experience and knowledge, but you also have a lot of clinical knowledge too, just in having worked with a lot of doctors, your insights are there. Where do you see this drug most succeeding? And we have a lot of listeners who want to understand the drug too, even though they may have heard of it, it's new to them, being the third drug approved. And at this time, a drug approved for signs and symptoms again. Where does it fit in, Kim?
Well, start out a little bit about some of the highlights of the product. It is very rapid acting. We see onset of action within a couple of days. The safety profile is very good. I mean, this product was really engineered with Kala's drug delivery technology. Our goal was to be able to get more drug into the ocular surface to get, maximize the effect. But still, it's loprednol. Less drug inside the eye to have less side effects. And I think we achieved that. We got very rapid onset of action. We got a very good safety profile. I mean, the most common AE that we've seen in our trials was ocular discomfort or burning and stinging, only in about 5% of patients, and basically the same as placebo. And if we look at IOP elevations, there's a number of ways to look at them. If we look at it as number of patients that have an elevation of 10 and go over 21, we only had 0.2% of patients that had that elevation. So that is a little backdrop. Where I see it, to give a little bit of an anecdote, I suffer from dry eye flares. And quite honestly, it took me a while to figure out exactly what it was. But there were certain times in the year, or when I was on the computer too much, or traveling on an airplane, when my eyes would really bother me. A lot of burning, stinging, all these things we used to ask. I initially thought it was allergies, so I put in allergy drops. They didn't do much. So I was at a meeting when I was probably at Inspire, yes, with Gary Fouts, and I explained it to Gary, and he looked at my eyes and pulled my lids down and said, son, you have dry eye, and you're probably having a flare. And then as we developed this product, my personal experience, it never bothered me enough to want to go on a chronic medication. I would get these flares 5-6 times a year, and I would always grit my way through it. It wasn't comfortable, but I wasn't exactly ready to go on a long-term therapy because I knew of the issues. I'd tried Restasis and the burning and stinging and taking it every day. So as we were developing this after the first clinical trials, we really started focusing on that as a key use of the product. And we found out in a lot of our research, talking to patients and to physicians, that 80 to 90% of the patients we talked to, whether they had continual symptoms of dry eye or not, but they were dry eye patients, suffered from these dry eye flares. And many of them echoed, what I just said. My thoughts were they weren't ready to go on a chronic med, or they took one of the more chronic medications, and it didn't work quick enough, or it wasn't tolerated enough. And, within the first couple of weeks, their flare would go away. So they're like, I don't need it. So I think that's one of the areas where this is going to have great utilization, is those patients that aren't well served with artificial tears, have these flares, and want to treat those acutely. And I think that is a key area where I think we'll see a lot of utilization.
I agree with you. I think myself, I can relate to that. And clinically, I have patients too who will mention, is there anything we can try besides going on chronic therapy? And if you're getting 4-6 episodes, that's going to play a role. The other thing that's exciting, and I agree with you, Kim, is that could be your earlier dry eye patient who just had the episodic episodes, yeah. Or it could be the more severe chronic patient who is on a chronic therapy but still gets breakthrough flare-ups, yes, 4 times a year. So,
in fact, in our research, what we found in talking to patients is that those that were taking Xiidra or Restasis, we started with Restasis and then Xiidra came out, had as many flares, and in general, more severe flares than those that weren't. So even patients that are maintained on one of the chronic medications do experience these flares and want relief.
Makes total sense. So, you're only the third company in this dry eye field to achieve what you've done, and most recent. So I guess you're finished with your work now. And
yes.
No, really. What is the next step for Acala? Is it just now focus on this great approval and all the utility and opportunities here? Are you already, looking to next?
We're already looking at the next things. We have a couple of very interesting products in our pipeline. We're working on some back of the eye products. One in particular, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor that inhibits VEGF, and using our drug delivery system, we've been able to show in animals at least very good penetration from a eye drop rather than injecting it in the back of the eye. We got very encouraging data where we can get in animals similar levels that you see with the tyrosine kinase inhibitor inserts that are now being put in intravitrally. So we've seen very good efficacy in animal models. of CNV, choroidal neovascularization, similar to that that you get with Avastin or Lucentis. So we're moving that into IND enabling studies, to use a little lingo here. So that we're hoping in the coming year or so, we'll be moving forward with that. We're also looking at a series of compounds. We're in a little earlier stage called Segrums, which are really selective inhibitors of glucocorticoid agonist glucocorticoid receptors. And, you know, if you hit a glucocorticoid receptor with a steroid, you stimulate two pathways. One's been shown to be primarily responsible for the efficacy, the anti-inflammatory effect. The other pathway has been associated more with the untoward effects. And so we're looking at molecules that are selective towards the good pathway and not the bad pathway. We'd love to have an anti-inflammatory agent that, and I think many have tried, but we'd love to have an anti-inflammatory agent that has the anti-inflammatory effect of a steroid, but be devoid or at least have significantly less than the steroid side effects. And we're also very actively looking at in-licensing opportunities. The company is in a very good financial situation, even without Isuvis. And then as Isuvis picks up, we'll have funding for that. So our goal is to build an ophthalmology company. And I think we've got a good start. We've got two products approved. We got three good programs in the preclinical stage. So we're looking to bring in an asset or two to kind of fill that gap.
Very exciting. Really wonderful. Dr. Brazel, it was a wonderful interview. Really, I loved your insights regarding, dissecting previous failures. So many people look at them as failures, yet they're really stepping stones towards, improving and getting to the next level. I like the surrounding yourself with good people. Like the importance of looking at smaller companies versus larger companies, know where your personality might fit in. You've done all of them, so it's terrific insight. And I certainly compliment you on very successful regulatory pathway for Isuvis, a very high bar. Very few people have achieved what you've just achieved, and exciting to see that the company isn't going to rest just on this success, but has a lot more in store for it. Always learn a lot when I have the time with you. Kim, it's a real pleasure. Thanks for taking time out of your very busy schedule in light of where you're at and taking time
to be part of this podcast. It's been a pleasure working with you over the years, and it's a pleasure being on with you today.
Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We hope this interview gave you a fresh perspective about navigating work with the FDA and that you were able to glean knowledge from hearing about Kim's storied career. We thank Kim Brazel for sharing these pearls of wisdom and thank him for his time. If you enjoy the OIS podcast, please subscribe, rate, and share with your colleagues to help spread the word. Until next week, keep innovating.